Billionaire Warren Buffett, the Oracle from Omaha, released his annual letter for shareholders. Investors are looking for Warren Buffett to give more of a sense of his succession plan and what he plans to do when he leaves his great empire. But he did say that America's economic soil is fertile, and that he loves running the business, so he wants to do it for as long as he can.
Australian scientists are taking their cue from space for a new method of shortening plant breeding cycles. When experts at the University of Queensland saw NASA using continuous light to trick wheat into rapidly growing in space, they wanted to try the same thing on Earth. They use LED lights continuously for 22 hours a day, triggering early reproduction in the plants, a technique they call speed breeding.
President Xi Jinping could be set up to be the leader of China indefinitely. The ruling Communist Party on Sunday proposed changes to a constitutional clause limiting presidential service to 2 5-year terms. Experts say that, in theory, could allow Xi to serve as long as he likes. But how long he will actually stay in power is hard to predict. Changes to the constitution in the last year have made Xi the most powerful Chinese leader since Mao Zedong, the founder of the People's Republic, who died in office having never retired.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Monday. It's February 26, 5:10 in the morning. Glad you're here with us for another edition of The Opening Bell. And another business day, another business week getting underway. We've got a good broadcast for you today. A little bit later in the program, Mike Quincy will be here from Consumer Reports talking about the 2018 automotive top picks. And in a minute, we'll bring in our CEO this morning from Braviant Holdings. Stephanie Klein is here. But first, let's update the markets this morning on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk. Dow futures were up 170 points this morning. NASDAQ and S&P futures are higher as well. Around the rest of the globe, the numbers are in the green in Europe, in London, Germany, and in France this morning. And in Asia, markets are generally higher as well. The Nikkei up almost 1%. Oil is trading at 50, make that 63.58 a barrel, which is up about 3 cents. A couple of big stories we're watching for you. The Supreme Court today hears arguments in a case that could deal a painful blow to organized labor unions. All eyes will be on Justice Neil Gorsuch today when the court takes up a challenge to an Illinois law that allows unions representing government employees to collect fees from workers who choose not to join. Unions say the outcome could affect more than 5 million government workers in 24 states and the District of Columbia. Axios is reporting that President Trump is pushing for his longtime personal pilot to head the Federal Aviation Administration. One senior administration official telling the Axios that Trump had recommended John Duncan, who flew Trump's plane campaign during the campaign. For the remainder of the campaign, the official says Duncan was interviewed for the post. Another administration official also confirmed that Duncan under consideration for the job, but that the pilot may not have the experience to lead the agency. John Duncan, the personal pilot of the president, would lead an administration that deals, the Federal Aviation Administration, with hundreds of pilots, thousands of pilots and airlines, and also has billions of dollars worth of the budget that it deals with there. One other big story, too, that we're watching is a business survey. A majority of the business economists now view the government's tax and spending policy as too aggressively done to stimulate economic growth, setting up a potential increase in the deficit in the coming year. That's according to a new survey. The views emerge from the latest economic policy by a survey by the National Association for Business Economics, polling 211 members at companies and industry groups. The survey by NABE, a professional association, says that 52% of economists who consider the government's fiscal policy too stimulative, compared with only 20% in August in the previous policy survey by that organization. Our CEO Spotlight this morning features Stephanie Klein. She's the CEO of Braviant Technology. When people need credit and can't get it from a bank, they turn to technology firms like Bravient, which is based here in Chicago. Investors are taking notice as well. Stephanie is with us this morning. Stephanie, good morning. Welcome to the Opening Bell.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about Bravient Holdings.
So at Bravient, we're using proprietary technology and advanced analytics to make smarter, faster lending decisions. And really, our mission is all about streamlining the borrowing process and increasing credit access for people who need it.
What kind of borrowing are we talking about?
Generally, we're talking about pretty small dollar loans, anywhere from $100 to $10,000.
And the customer base would be what? Is there a demographic that you're after, or is there a customer base you're after?
Yeah, absolutely. We talk about this market that we call underserved. So the FDIC has said that 20% of U.S. population is underbanked. That means they have a checking account, potentially a savings account, but they're using alternative finance products to meet the rest of their needs, products that you can't get at a mainstream bank. And so that's really our customer base. Some other stats, one in three people can't come up with $2,000 to cover an unexpected expense. And so I think there's a real need out there. 46% of people have non-prime credit scores. So this isn't, a 5 or 10% niche of the economy. It's really middle America.
And so what kind of interest rates are we talking about? What kind of repayment terms are there?
Yeah, sure. So interest rates can vary across the industry. And generally, it's kind of a risk-based pricing model. And so, if you're talking a $100 loan or a $1,000 loan versus a $10,000 loan, there's going to be a lot of variance. But I think where the market is moving in general, and what I've seen is a lot of increased competition, and especially for these small dollar loans, moving from single pay kind of payday products of the past toward installment loans where a customer can borrow up front and pay back over time. So what that might look like is instead of borrowing $400 and owing $500 back on your next paycheck, you can borrow a larger amount. Again, that stat, one in three don't have $2,000. So back in the day, you'd have to take 5 payday loans and juggle all those balloon payments, which is really difficult. So what we're seeing today is people who can lend a couple $1,000 and say, hey, you can pay this back over 6 or 12 or 18 months. We're not going to take more than 10 or 15% of your net paycheck for this unsecured loan.
And that sort of dovetails into my next question. How are you different from payday loan companies? We don't see as many of those anymore, and they seem to be going away. You mentioned the balloon payments and the high interest rates.
Right.
So explain to us how you're different.
Yeah, I think, a reason that payday exists is because there is a credit need. And in the U.S., you've got federal law, but you also have state-by-state laws that sort of dictate what product can offer. And so I think back in the day, especially with storefront lending, payday was sort of an easy product. It doesn't require a ton of technology. I give you $400, you give me back $500. Mm-hmm. Very simple and straightforward. And really where the market is moving toward is online. And this is not a surprise, right? Because this is any industry. But there's been a huge shift from sort of brick and mortar payday type products to online products, installment products, line of credit products, products that partner with banks instead of necessarily being licensed state by state in order to increase access.
The payday loan industry got a really bad rap, and I don't know, maybe it's just my projection onto it, but it seemed with the stores that they had located in strip malls and other places, it seemed like a seedy industry. This seems like it's more mainstream. Is that a bad way to describe it, or a good way to describe it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, there are probably, like any industry, good players and really good ethical people in the payday business. And then there are probably some people who aren't operating from a place of integrity, mm-hmm. Maybe aren't offering a product that has a true value proposition to the customer, or, even a product that's compliant. And so I think these days people are realizing there's a huge need. There's a lot of value that can be created. You've got VC companies and PE companies funding these types of businesses, but you have to run your business the right way. You have to offer products that are really going to help people not just meet their immediate credit need, but build toward a better future. Report back to the credit bureau, start building credit history when they don't have it, things like that.
I love the way you describe that, a place of integrity. And that's shown with the recent equity raise that you had.
Yes.
$7 million. Congratulations.
Thank you. A big milestone for Bravient, and hopefully the first of many raises.
You mentioned, though, that you have to answer to those VC folks. Describe when you do that, how that works, and why this is important.
Yeah. So I would say, What we're trying to build with Braviance, it's not a let's make cash fast and then get out. We're trying to build a multi-billion dollar business because that's the level of need that's out there. So personal loans in the U.S. are about an $80 billion market today. And I saw a stat from TransUnion in 2010, 1% of that market was fintechs like us. And in 2017, it was a third. So there's a huge growing market. Yeah. There's a lot of long-term value that you can create. But I do think integrity is really important. And integrity doesn't always just mean you're following state law. Sometimes it means that, you know, within the state law, there's different ways you can operate. Let's figure out the right way to operate. You know, the state might allow you to charge 8 times what someone borrowed to pay back their loan. Mm-hmm. Maybe you should only charge 2, mm-hmm. right? And so there's things like that that I think are really important if a company wants to create long-term value. You've got to be serving your customers. You've got to be treating your customers with respect, or you're not going to be around in 10 years, and you're not going to be a part of that growing market when hopefully fintechs are 80%, right, 5 years from now of the market.
And so it's important not only to be able to raise that capital, but to protect your brand. And if you want to expand to be a national company, that loyalty and brand identity is important.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very important to make sure that we're putting forth a product that we're proud of. And, you know, sometimes there will be questions, there will be complaints, and we need to take those really seriously and address those quickly. But I think, you know, overall, the companies that are going to make it long term are companies where people are really satisfied with the service. If they have a need again in the future, they're going to think of you first and say, hey, these guys helped me. And then in some cases, especially for us, we're serving people that are underserved by the banks. So ideally, some people graduate out of our products, and that's not a bad thing. You know, if we can help people graduate to lower rate products, you know, borrow $5,000 to $10,000 instead of $500 to $1,000, and then eventually they go off and they get, you know, credit cards, you know, mortgages, things like that, that we don't offer. That's a really positive benefit for society.
Right now, your headquarters is here in Chicago, and you're only available in a few states, but I'm guessing the plan is to make that more.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're in 10 states today, and we operate, you know, using state licenses. So one by one, we kind of look at every state's different regulations, and there's different banking departments and such that regulate this industry. And so we'll go out and we'll get a small dollar loan license or a consumer lending license, all different names. But really, the long-term plan is a bank partnership. And there are a lot of people in the space that are using this model today, where essentially we can be that fintech service provider to the bank. So we know how to acquire the customers digitally. We've got the technology to underwrite in seconds and give someone a real-time loan offer online, you know, from their phone, from whatever device they're using. And that's technology and experiences that the banks really can't offer today. And so one of the trends I would say I've seen in the space is, you know, 5-10 years ago, everyone talked about disrupting the banks. Now the conversation is, how can we partner with banks? How can we work together to create more credit access and a better experience for consumers?
Why a headquarters in Chicago?
Yeah, so Chicago, you know, it's interesting. Not always one of the top places that people talk about when you think of banking or even fintech. You know, obviously, San Francisco area gets a lot of recognition, and even East Coast to some extent. But Chicago's honestly a great place for talent. You're right in the middle of the country. So if you're trying to go raise money out on, you know, the East Coast, or you're trying to go to a conference on the West Coast, really easy to get everywhere. I think there's great talent. You know, the Big Ten schools, the MBA programs, you know, Kellogg and Booth are some of the best in the country, really some of the best in the world. And so Chicago is an awesome place. And I think we're getting some of that recognition more recently. I mean, certainly some household names have come out of Chicago, whether it's Grubhub, Groupon, Cars.com, Guaranteed Rate, some of these types of companies. And in my industry in particular, there's also really become this sort of fintech online lending hub. Companies like Innova, who went public a couple years ago and have been doing very well recently, Avant, OpLoans, and now Braviant. So I think it's an awesome place to be located, and really it's just all about finding the right talent.
Yeah. And you personally getting credit for a lot of this. So you were recently named the finalist for FinTech Woman of the Year. Obviously, something about your CEO leadership propelling you and this company forward. What would you tell our audience that is?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, the biggest thing that I realize is that I can't do this alone. So as a leader, it's not my job to have all the answers. It's not my job to make all the decisions or always be right. I need to be able to recruit people, in many cases, who are smarter than me, right? Especially in their particular function. So we do a lot of really cool machine learning stuff. I personally have no idea how to build a gradient boost machine learning model. But I understand the importance. I know how to kind of analyze the lift and think about what is the business value and how can this type of modeling help our consumers. And so really, as a leader, it's my job to hire people, quite frankly, who are in many cases smarter than I am, set a clear vision so that people understand the expectation, and then figure out, how do I remove barriers? Hey, I've got this really smart person and we have a clear vision, so what can I do to help everybody be successful?
Mm-hmm. What kind of challenges does that prevent when you as the CEO are not the smartest person in the room? Is it hard to be that person's team leader or guide them?
No, you know, I don't think it is. And maybe even smart isn't the best word, but it's just the most educated on a particular topic. You know, I just find that people who think they know everything generally don't, right? There's so much to learn. I've been in fintech for 10 years, and there's still more that I don't know than I do know. And so for me, my personal style, and people on my team will tell you this, and maybe sometimes it drives them a little bit nuts, I ask a ton of questions. You know, when I hear something, you kind of start at that face value of what you hear, and then you start asking about the how and the why, and you dig deeper. And that's really how I learn and get informed so that I can add value. I can contribute to a brainstorming conversation, and I can make sure that we're making the right decision. And I think that's actually a really positive thing, because think about someone junior to an organization who might be scared to ask a question. Mm-hmm. And if you don't ask, you don't learn. And so to me, what I've seen is having that culture from the top of, hey, we're not here to know everything, but let's ask questions, let's form hypotheses, and then let's figure out a way to test it. Data will tell us what the right answer is. So A-B test something, right? And that's really kind of what Braviance is all about and what our culture is all about.
You learn too from each other, and perhaps you have a tech person who is who knows about the AI and knows about the tech platforms, but doesn't necessarily have people skills. I mean, that's where you come in, right?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think there's a lot of gaps that have to be bridged to build a successful business. You've got product development, you've got marketing and customer acquisition, technology, analytics. And so a big part of my role is making sure that people aren't off in their silos running off, you know, along on different roadmaps, right? What is our global vision? What is the roadmap? What's really demoralizing is for someone in analytics to build a model that has a lot of lift and then find out that that can't get into the dev pipeline until 6 months later. Mm-hmm. Or if you're at a big bank, 12, 18, 24 month life cycles. And so really a lot of my job is, hey, where do we want to be? Where do we want to be in a year or in 5 years? And let's work backwards. What are the most important things we can do today to get there? And let's make sure everyone's aligned. So we're building models because technology knows that they're going to get that new model in a month, and they're going to have the resources ready to deploy it very quickly. And there's also, you know, technology is huge in our space. So it's not just the project management. It's how do we build an infrastructure that's flexible, that's scalable? How do we make sure we can release something new in a day or a couple weeks and it doesn't take months of effort through a long, you know, waterfall process?
When there's a hiccup or a roadblock in the way, how do you help your team get through challenges like that?
I think for me, I tend to jump into action mode. So if we're going through something challenging, it's all about what can we do? How can we solve this problem? You know, you can dwell on it and you can be frustrated. And look, sometimes I get frustrated and we sit in an open office so people can see it. They can see, you know, when we closed our equity deal, I think the whole team knew before I even announced it because I got it was actually a text message. Hey, deal is signed. And, you know, but that being said, I think when times are tough, you have to focus on, what are the takeaways? What can I do? What can we do moving forward to get to a better place? And what are those action items that are going to propel the business through this challenge? And so that's what I like to focus on. It's not dwelling on the past or pointing fingers or blame or who made a mistake. It's, hey, here's where we are today. This is where we want to be in the future. So let's work through this together.
In your upbringing and in your career, what is there a moment or a part of that resume that's helped prepare you for now?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, I spent a lot of years at Enova, and I was at Enova at a really cool time. I was a couple years out of school, and I remember I interviewed with the CEO and the CFO and the COO, which was really crazy because I was a junior, you know, financial analyst at the time. But also, these were people that were in like their late 20s, that were entrepreneurs and had started to build a business that was growing really fast. And so I think for me, the pivotal moment in my career was when I sort of transitioned from that finance role behind the scenes, forecasting the numbers or reporting on the results, into a role actually building the business. And that was really an opportunity that I had because I had some great mentors and some great advocates, I would say, some senior leaders internally at Enova that said, hey, you may not have the resume for this, because quite frankly, you know, when I got my first P&L management role as sort of a general manager of my own business at Enova, nobody outside of Enova would have hired me for that role. There was nothing on my resume that said I should do that. I was a finance manager. Mm-hmm. And suddenly it was, hey, we want to build this new personal loan business. We think there's this opportunity for people who, they're not the payday loan customer, but they're not prime yet. There's this big space in the middle and nobody is serving them. And I had the opportunity to take a leadership role and figure out the 8-month pre-launch and build out that business and start to ramp it. And so again, really, it was just figuring out how do I add more value in my finance role and getting on some people's radars where they're like, you know what? Steph is pretty smart. She hasn't done this before, but she can think and she can probably figure it out. And it was scary. I remember when I first got asked, hey, do you want this role? I thought, maybe I don't want it because what if I fail? But, you know, had I not taken that opportunity, no way would I be where I am today. And so definitely no regrets.
Outside of the company, outdoors, there's this wonderful national conversation going on about women in the workplace, women in the boardroom, equality. Do those discussions come into your company because you're a female CEO? And if not, would you like them to, or do you spread them around your colleagues and mentors and peers?
It's really interesting being a female CEO and also being a small company. You know, a couple years ago, we were 12 people and now we're 40. And I was looking at the stats actually recently because it feels like we have a lot of women, but I had never sat there and counted heads. Yeah. And so I counted. And I think with a couple offers that were just signed, we're at about 19 women out of 40, so almost 50%. And data tells me that that's unusual. And so I look back and I think, well, what have we really done differently? And I can't pinpoint anything. We've just hired the best candidates for the job. But I do think there's an intangible effect. And I heard an anecdote that really made this clear to me recently about having a woman in that role. And so the anecdote I heard was someone that we had recruited. She actually relocated from the East Coast to Chicago for this opportunity. And her manager told me, you know, hey, I heard that after this person accepted the role, they called their mom and said, hey, you're never going to believe it. I'm going to work for a female CEO. And so I think just getting into those leadership positions and having that visibility does have an intangible effect. But now that we're at 40 people and we want to get to the next, you know, let's call it 80 people in a year, we do have to think about it a little harder. And it's something that I want to focus on. But at the end of the day, it's really about the pipeline. How do we get a broad, diverse set of people into the pipeline? And then I firmly believe you hire the best person for the role. And if you do that, you're going to have diversity across gender, ethnicity, you know, whatever it may be.
You mentioned earlier your mentor. You had a mentor. This is a regular point of conversation on this broadcast. We talk about that a lot with our CEOs. How do you give back in that role? Are you a mentor? And how do you encourage others on your staff to be mentors?
Yeah, I think it's really important. And like I said, I wouldn't have the opportunities that I've had if it wasn't for somebody who took a chance on me. And so it's something where, you know, if people reach out to me, hey, I want to learn more about fintech. Can we hop on a call or can we have an informal coffee? You just have to say yes to those opportunities, whether it's junior talent who's looking to break into the industry, whether it's someone who has a connection. You went to Booth, I went to Booth. You know, could we have a conversation? And so that's definitely something that I try to do in any way that I can. It's generally been pretty informal and pretty organic. And really, that's how my opportunities evolved. I think it's important to find those mentors. And if you have to put a little purposeful effort in, you should do that. You know, but again, in my case, it was really just a matter of figuring out how to make myself useful. You know, how can I go above and beyond? How can I predict what's going to help the senior executive make a better decision and put that information in front of them? And through that, I developed those relationships naturally. And so certainly it's an obligation, I would say, to give back.
Speaking of predictions, this is the moment in the interview when I ask you for your predictions. Where would you like to be? Where would you like your company to be in 5 or 10 years?
Yeah, so I think in 5 years, you know, we've served a little over 100,000 customers today over the past couple of years. So in 5 years, I expect that number to be millions. You know, at the end of the day, we want to make a big impact. I talked about 20% of the population being underbanked. That's 25 million households, more than that in terms of individual people. And so there's millions of people out there that need access to credit, and they need high quality solutions. They need solutions that are transparent, that are compliant, and that create a real value proposition. So 5 years out, I'm going to hope we've served millions of customers, that we've kind of, you know, done what we set out to do and really increased access. And who knows, maybe I'll be a public company CEO.
Excellent. Well, we wish you the best of luck, Stephanie. It's wonderful meeting you, and best to everybody at Bravient Holdings.
You too. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Stephanie Klein is the CEO of Bravient Holdings. We're going to continue our conversation with Stephanie after the bell this morning and post more of our interview in the podcast of the opening bell when it hits WGNradio.com a little later on this morning. So make sure you find that a little bit later on at WGNradio.com.
Hi, this is Catherine Davis with today's Inno Minute on WGN Radio, a rundown of all the Chicago innovation and tech news you need to know, delivered by ChicagoInno.com. Chicago Tech Hub 1871 was ranked first in the world among university-affiliated business incubators for its impact among local startups and its dedication to diversity. The list, put together by Sweden-based UBI Global, ranks business incubators based on factors like how much value they bring to their members and their overall economic impact. Soylent, the meal replacement technology company, is making its product more widely available in Chicago. The company announced that it has a deal in place to bring the beverage to 800 7-Eleven locations in Chicago, Boston, Washington, D.C., Denver, and Las Vegas. And ServiceNow, a Silicon Valley software company, is opening an engineering center in Chicago with plans to hire 150 workers over the next 2 years. Chicago beat out a handful of other cities to land ServiceNow, which was founded in 2004 and makes nearly $2 billion in annual revenue. That's today's Inno Minute from WGN Radio. Learn more at ChicagoInno.com and sign up for The Beat, our daily email newsletter.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us for our Monday edition of The Opening Bell. In the market for a new car, Consumer Reports is out with its manufacturer report card, the top picks. 2018 automotive top picks. Mike Quincy is with us this morning. He's an automotive specialist at Consumer Reports. Mike, good morning. Welcome to the Opening Bell.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Always an exciting segment that we do. You guys do a wonderful job doing these cars, and I know this is like the time of year when people come to you to find out what you've selected. Let's talk about what you've done this year. First, I guess, let's talk about how you do it.
Well, at Consumer Reports, as many of you and your listeners know, we're an independent organization, which means we don't take any advertising, so we're not swayed by how we're going to rate products, and we buy our own products. So all the cars that are in the April issue of Consumer Reports that we've tested, we've purchased. And that allows us, again, to be independent and to really tell it like it is. We have a 327-acre test facility here in Connecticut, and we do all the cars, the tires, and the child safety seats here. And the top picks in our April issue are really the best of the best.
You mentioned you put these cars through the paces. What are you looking for specifically as you do that?
Well, to become a top pick for Consumer Reports, these are the models that do really well in our ratings, and we have over 50 tests that we put all the vehicles through, from handling, fuel economy, acceleration, braking, and whatnot. We also do surveys of our subscribers that tell us about reliability and owner satisfaction, and a top pick has to score well in both of those categories. And finally, we look at safety. We look at models that do well in government or insurance institute crash tests, and we give extra points for models that have standard active safety systems, such as forward collision warning and automatic emergency braking.
I think people who are out there who are car nuts probably think you have one of the best jobs in the country.
It's either that or working in radio, right? I mean,
exactly. Well, Mike, let's go down the list here. What do you like? Let's start with compact car.
The top pick from Consumer Reports April issue for a compact car is the Toyota Corolla. One of the reasons that we really like the Corolla is it gets excellent fuel economy, 32 miles per gallon overall, and really an outstanding 43 miles per gallon on the highway. It's quiet, it's comfortable, it has that awesome Toyota reliability. For about $20,000 for a new car, the Corolla does a lot of things really well.
And historically, too, the Toyota Corolla has always been a favorite of not only people who buy it, but of your magazine too, aren't they?
Well, sure. I mean, and it's, you know, the Toyotas get kind of a bad rap because a lot of people say they're kind of boring to drive and whatnot. But there's a lot of people out there, a lot of car buyers out there that really don't care about having razor sharp handling or a status symbol. They want an appliance. They want a car that gets them from A to B. And for many people, certainly people in the market for maybe their first new car, a Corolla is a great place to start.
Let's move on to the compact green car. This one is one that is making a lot of lists this year.
You know, you have to tip your hat to Chevrolet, because the top pick in Consumer Reports green car category is the Chevrolet Bolt. And some people confuse it with the Volt with a V. This is Bolt with a B. And the Bolt is an all-electric car, so there's no gas engine. But for people that have a generally short commute, I believe the national survey is something like the average commute is around 20 miles for most people. The Bolt has a 250-mile all-electric range, which really should take care of some people's range anxiety. It's actually very fun to drive. It's easy to park. It's small. If you work for a place that has a plug-in system for your car, even if you have a slightly longer commute, you can plug in while you work. It takes about 10 hours to recharge on a 240-volt outlet. And so, I mean, if you've ever considered an electric car before, I would definitely check out the Chevrolet Bolt.
Mike, how does that 250-mile range compare to other similar models that are out there? It's one of the highest, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, the Nissan Leaf was just redesigned, but the previous Leaf didn't come close to this kind of range. So we'll have to see how the new Leaf goes. And there aren't a lot of other electric cars out there except for Tesla. But I mean, Tesla's everybody is wow over Tesla, and they have about a 200-mile range in the Model S that we last tested. But we're also looking at about $60,000 or $70,000 for a Tesla, and the Chevrolet Bolt comes in around $38,000, but there also might still be some national tax incentives, so you might get like a $7,500 break on that.
Yeah, the charge anxiety part of this is a big deal with people buying electric cars. You don't see many of these electric charging stations around. Is that changing, or will change soon, we hope?
I think it is changing. I think that the battery technology is growing by leaps and bounds. I certainly hear in the Northeast, and I believe it in other kind of affluent places, like California, for example. You'll find charging stations for Teslas all over the place. Teslas are so popular there; they're almost like a dime a dozen, if you believe that. But yeah, it is the infrastructure is not there yet. You don't have electric charging stations like you have gas stations all over the place. So, but I think it's on the rise. I think it's coming.
Well, let's hit the luxury compact.
The luxury compact car in the April issue of Consumer. Sorry, I just got a sip of coffee there.
That's
thought
right.
I had a second. the BMW X3 takes our prize as the best luxury compact SUV. This is listen, everyone's buying SUVs these days, and the X3 is one of these models that's actually really fun to drive. It has good steering. It has good handling. The acceleration from the base turbo four-cylinder engine is strong. They also have a really hot rod version called the M40i, which comes in at 355 horsepower, and that really is a gas to drive. But if you're looking for something quiet, something comfortable, good seats, the X3 is a really nice choice for about $53,000.
The compact SUV, I've seen a lot of these on the road lately, the Subaru Forester.
Yeah, it's good. It's nice that you say that coming out of Chicago, because usually a Subaru is really big in the Northeast. So it's nice to see that the company is branching out and really getting even greater sales in other parts of the country. The Forester is one of those models that does so many things well. It's quiet. It's comfortable. It has excellent reliability, about 26 miles per gallon overall, which makes it pretty competitive for an SUV of its size. The standard 2.5-liter engine has decent performance. You can also get a turbocharged model if you want a little bit more zip. There's a lot of room inside the Forester, and it has excellent visibility all around.
The midsize SUV, the Toyota Highlander, is back again this year.
The Highlander, year in and year out, always seems to be near the top of Consumer Reports ratings. One of the reasons that it gives you is a great variety of choices. So you can just get your basic V6 model that pulls in about 22 miles per gallon overall. But if you get the hybrid model, you're getting 25 miles per gallon overall, which is really pretty exceptional considering that it's a three-row SUV. It has a typical great Toyota reliability. It did very well in our road test. It's a nice family vehicle. It's kind of one of those things that you want something practical, but maybe you don't want a minivan. The Highlander is a really good place to go.
And you mentioned this is good for families. The safety on this is scored up there on the safety, didn't it, as well?
Toyota has done an awesome job with making forward collision warning and automatic emergency braking standard on all of their products, and we really tip our hat to Toyota for doing that. And we, it's kind of a a reminder to all the manufacturers that they should be making this safety equipment standard and certainly available on all the models. A lot of manufacturers make you get the top of the line model to get all the safety features, and we don't think that's right.
Here's a hot to wrap up the list here. The full sized pickup truck is that beautiful Ford F-150.
Yeah, you know, you got to give Ford credit. They really took a big risk by putting greater use of aluminum and high strength steel in their new F-150. They made it about 700 pounds lighter, which is really incredible. You combine that with the efficient 2.7-liter turbocharged V6 engine, and it pulls in 19 miles per gallon overall. That's the best fuel economy of any non-diesel pickup truck that Consumer Reports has tested. But the thing that gets you about the F-150 is it's so quiet inside. You almost feel like you're driving in a luxury car. It's so quiet. It's good. They have good seats. They have good controls, decent reliability. If you're in the market for a pickup truck, and it is the number one selling nameplate in the history of the world, it seems, definitely check out the Ford F-150.
We didn't get we don't have enough time to go through the others here. Midsize car was the Toyota Camry, but I do want to talk about the large car, the Chevy Impala. Boy, this thing has been redesigned where it looks beautiful.
It is such a solid performer. It's been on Consumer Reports top picks for many years. People can't believe that Chevrolet can put out a full-size car that is that competitive, but it's really holding up well. The reliability has been strong. Owner satisfaction is strong. The V6 engine is an excellent performer. Don't write off the American car companies when it comes to. I mean, everyone's buying SUVs, but if you're sick of SUVs, you really want just a decent car. Check out the Chevrolet Impala. It'll impress the heck out of you.
Yeah, I think what was the price on that? $39,000. Something like that.
39, yeah, for a well-equipped model like the one that we test, you can get them for a little bit less. But we definitely hold out and get the V6 engine. The standard four-cylinder is a little weak, so definitely get the V6.
What's the market like for minivans? Because you've tested the and ranked the Toyota Sienna as one of the best.
Toyota shows up on Consumer Reports top picks list yet again with the Sienna minivan. It's always usually a tough battle between the Toyota Sienna and Honda Odyssey, but because of the Sienna's superior reliability, we give the nod to this company. With the Sienna offering all-wheel drive, that's also a big drawing card for people certainly live in Chicago, any place that it snows. It's the only minivan available with all-wheel drive. The standard V6 engine pulls in about 21 miles per gallon overall, pretty competitive. You have seating for eight. You have easy controls. You know, this is a car that you kind of set it and forget it. You don't have to worry about this one starting up in the morning and hauling your kids and stuff around all the time.
Mike, good information. Thanks for sharing it with us. Of course, we'll tell everybody to head to consumerreports.org so they can see all of these up close and personal and get more information if they're in the business of buying a car soon. We appreciate your expertise on this matter.
Thanks so much for having me on.
All right, Mike Quincy, automotive specialist at Consumer Reports. Again, consumerreports.org. You can see the whole list of cars, the top 10 cars. There's photographs and all kinds of information. You can even take a poll there to see which one you'd be most likely to buy. Again, consumerreports.org.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, Dow futures up 160 points, NASDAQ futures up 20. S&P futures are up about 11 points. Let's get the latest on agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. As we wind down the week of February, cattle traders will be watching the cattle market today for the impact of the cattle on feed report that came out on Friday afternoon after the markets closed. Here are the numbers. Number of cattle on feed February 1st at 11,630,000. That's up from last year's 10,782,000. The number of cattle placed on feed in January 2018, 2,068,000 head. That's up from last year's 1,981,000. And the number of cattle marketed in January at 1,858,000 head. That's up from last year's 1,751,000. So we'll have to wait to see how the cattle market reacts to those numbers this morning. And on Friday, the February cattle contract ended down 22 cents and the April cattle feed contract ended down 52 cents. Meanwhile, hogs on Friday for the April or for the May contract up 15 cents a hundredweight. Turning to the grain market, well, you know what's making news there. The drought in Argentina, it's continuing, and that sent soybeans Friday near a one-year high. As we say goodbye to the month of February, we slow down on the farm meeting event calendar, but this week, Commodity Classic in Anaheim, California, that gets underway on Wednesday. Thank you for joining us. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk outlook for Monday, February 26th. Various reports related to housing among a bulk of major economic data to be released this week. Starting today with a report on new home sales for January. Also today, the Mobile World Congress kicks off. We'll get a look at Chicago Fed national activity and the index coming out. Dallas Fed manufacturing survey also due out. Standard & Poor's releases the Case-Shiller Index of Home Prices for December tomorrow. On Wednesday, the National Association of Realtors releases its pending home sales index for January. And then Freddie Mac, the mortgage company, releases this week's average mortgage rates on Thursday. Busy week for earnings continues as well. We'll see Macy's tomorrow, Priceline, also Express Scripts, Discovery Communications on Wednesday, Lowe's, Salesforce, L Brands, Monster Beverage, and then on Thursday, Best Buy, Kohl's, Nordstrom, Gap, Barnes & Noble. So we'll see a lot of retail earnings coming for the rest of the week. JCPenney on Friday along with Foot Locker. Some of the things that could move the markets.